Lord be with you.
And also with you.
I had soy milk this morning, and it's making me feel a little prophetic. I've never had soy milk in my life, and it was an accident this morning. It was already in my coffee when I looked at the sign on the pot. Then I said to my wife, after a half a cup, where do you go to throw the coffee out and start over again? Although we first had a debate at our table, could you really tell between soy milk and... And then that led to a discussion of, was soy milk much kindlier to the environment? No dairy farms and things. I was also struck, I was instructed at 8:30 this morning that I was to ring my own bell. It seems a highly un-Scandinavian thing to do. My wife, a Swede, would never ring her own bell, and if she did, it would be a very modest, gentle peal. I'm German, however, so I rang it lustily and repeatedly. In biblical interpretation, sometimes called in seminaries hermeneutics, there's at least two quite different ways of going at a text. I mean, any text, a classical text, but in this case, a biblical text. One is to try to cleanse your mind from as many modern preconceptions as possible and the received assumptions that prevail in your own upbringing, and go with a kind of pure mind, to the extent that that's possible, to the original text and the citing of the original text, and see how much you can hear that will be new from that original text before you then return to wonder how this text speaks to you today. So that's a pretty classic hermeneutical approach. But it's not the one I'm going to do in this five-day series. I'm starting at the other end. And in this method, you try to imagine yourself back into, in case you'd forgotten, your own modern context. What are the issues? What are people talking about? What are the burning questions of the day? How do they influence you? What's going on? And then, with all those questions and issues and perplexities and uncertainties swirling in your mind, you go back to some biblical texts, but with the operant questions in your mind from your own times. And you sort of ransack. You invade the ancient text with those modern questions. A slightly more devotional way to say it is you try to invite God to speak to you who once spoke through an ancient text to your questions today. So that's the approach we'll be taking. And if you happen to read on the kiosk or outside here what the context of today that I'm proposing is, I'll just read it to you. During the 2008 election season, most Americans, including most Christians, were astonished and troubled at the sermons of candidate Obama's Chicago pastor, Jeremiah Wright, and of YouTube fame. How could a preacher, an American preacher, be so anti-American? But Pastor Wright, in defense, insisted he was being prophetic, a historic calling the Jewish and Christian traditions have long recognized, and that American religious people presumably would know something about. So that could lead to a question that no one on cable news asked: what is a prophet, anyway? Can we still imagine them, or have we lost the capacity to imagine them? Or have we decided, like typically Lutherans think about speaking in tongues, that it was good for the Book of Acts, but it is now obsolete and antiquarian and something that God no longer requires to be interesting? So then I picked for this series three prophets from the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. Moses, the prototypical prophet that we're looking at today. Then Elijah. Then my actual favorite, Amos. Then John the Baptist, who would widely be seen, I think, and is seen in the New Testament as a prophetic figure. It's the way Handel pictures him in the Messiah, and it's the way the Gospels picture him. And then on Friday, closing with Jesus, who may or may not be thought of as a prophet, and who probably did think of himself as in the Israelite prophetic tradition. So, with Elijah tomorrow, my favorite line where prophets are concerned in the Old Testament, when Elijah comes back into the precincts of the king, a king's messenger greets him, as we all learned in the King James Version, "Art thou he who troublest Israel?" Are you the troublemaker? In Amos, a messenger, a chaplain to the king's court, greets Amos and says, "You're on the king's territory," which I'm calling inside the beltway, "and don't you know that only royal prophets are, that is to say, on the king's salary, are welcome inside the beltway? And the rest of you, so let's say the whole ELCA, is part of a public deal where you keep your prophetic voice hidden from public view." Then John the Baptist and Herod and Jesus. So if someone has, so we'll start by just hearing again very brief snippets from Moses. If someone could read Exodus 3:4-14, please. Just fire away, please.
"When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush, 'Moses, Moses.' And he said, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground.' He said further, 'I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.' And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, 'I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israel has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. But come, I will send you to the Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt.' But Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go out to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?' He said, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on the mountain.' But Moses said to God, 'If I come to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?' God said to Moses, 'I am who I am.' He said further, 'Thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you.'"
Okay, so with that still ringing in your ears, of course you know this story probably, though in universities we are always astonished at the amount of biblical illiteracy that characterizes the current generation of students, but probably doesn't so much apply to you. Any comments about this very famous story? This is really sort of the prologue of the great Exodus narratives. But any comments? Yeah.
Moses didn't aspire to this position. He was resistant.
Yeah. Yeah, which we'll come to in the first question. And this is almost a kind of tagline for all the prophets, most of the prophets in the Old Testament. None of them wanted the office. Amos famously says, you know, I'm just a farmer. And Elijah spends a lot of time feeling sorry for himself that, you know, I'm the only guy left that really believes in the true God. So the prophetic resistance is a big theme in John the Baptist seems eager for it, but generally resistance. Yeah.
It just seems like Moses needs to get a huge sign, this burning bush. It's a wacky thing. It's unnatural. You know, God has to kind of slap him across the face to get his attention.
Yeah. Yeah. I know there's at least one pastor in the group, and maybe you're all pastors. Who knows? Wouldn't it be interesting if seminaries these days said as a condition of your first call that you had a burning bush experience? My wife grew up in evangelical, so everybody know that lingo there. But it would be quite astonishing. I sat on a candidacy committee for PLTS in Berkeley for a few years. And the faculty, who it seemed to me thought of themselves as academics, would sometimes say to the candidacy committee, hey, this person passed, you know, so make them a minister, give them a call. And we would sometimes say, I don't know, you know, I don't see it here. In California, we have this for school teachers, and probably every state, school teachers too. Even if they've got their credential and everything, they still have to pass a board that looks into their character. You know, not quite asking, have you had a burning bush experience, but, you know, maybe do you love children? And these days, do you love children in the proper ways? So we mostly have erased that, I think. In the Lutheran, in the Protestant tradition generally, at least mainstream Protestantism, we probably don't require burning bush experiences. And maybe also we don't, some preachers, I have been accused of this, of excessive glibness. Like, you don't sound like you're a holy ground person. I don't see you taking your shoes off before you open your mouth out of modesty, humility, awe. You know, I don't hear enough, my wife sometimes says to me, I don't hear enough awe in your voice, except when I'm speaking of her, of course. So these are dimensions of the prophet that may or may not characterize a modern pastor or a modern Christian. But how about the last line of this thing? So Moses says, how should I introduce you? A kind of funny question, it always seems to modern people. And God says, I am who I am. You know, I've been working on that line since I was a kid, since I was in prep school in the Missouri Synod system in ninth grade. I am who I am. What could that possibly mean? Some of you who have been to Lutheran colleges or seminaries or Christian colleges and seminaries might know that a common modern translation from Hebrew Bible scholars is even more exciting and opaque, I will be who I will be. Okay? So some modern versions say that, in which God appears as an uncontrollable, undefinable divine being who is not just exactly at beck and call and can't be tethered to your own tent stake. Too free for that. But even if we stick with I am who I am, which is still what the RSV is sticking to, What does that strike you as meaning?
Being itself, to me.
Okay. But how's that going to help anybody understand God? I mean, I get that if a person is saying that about himself as a kind of psychological portrait, but what would it mean about God?
It strikes me that it's resisting a label.
Oh, okay.
At that time, it's so
yeah, hard. Okay.
So mm-hmm. easily labeled statues.
Yeah.
I tend to move it toward the one who is, for some reason. The, mm. Whether I am or not, or whether mm. I care or mm. not. I, mm.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, you know, the verb to be is an amazing verb.
Yeah.
And it can reflect on anything and everything. Mm. And that's kind of how I've thought of it. I mean, it's a weird passage, very weird passage.
Yeah.
But it just seems like it reflects throughout the universe on mm-hmm. all sorts of things.
In every language, as those of you who studied languages know, the verb to be is an irregular verb. You know, it doesn't follow any rules. It's complex, it's rich, it sometimes seems cobbled together from several root stems and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, I am who I am to me. It immediately implies a context where you're perhaps questioning something someone has done. How can you do something bad? You know, mm-hmm. something you didn't expect or like. Mm-hmm. And this I am who I am, you know, it's almost like a teenager.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Almost, so that too, I guess to me that conjures up this idea that whoever I am isn't always going to be somebody I like, or because you wouldn't just say I am good. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does that also connotate the don't question me?
Oh, okay. And to the person who said maybe it's a label resistor, you may know that in ancient societies, surely not just in the Old Testament society, the power of naming is very powerful in a way that isn't true today. We don't typically, you know, when we name our kid Jenny, you know, we don't know that it happens to be the top five names that year, and that's why we probably did it, even though we didn't know it. And we don't imagine that Jenny had profound significance when we picked that name or something. But in other cultures, to disclose one's name is to be disclosive of one's self. And maybe God doesn't just want to, you know, pour it all out on the first date. Wants to be mysterious and not easily manipulated. Okay, let's keep moving. Would somebody read Exodus 4, 10 to 13? Please.
But Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor even now that you have spoken to your servant. But I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Then the Lord said to him, Who gives speech to mortals? Who makes them mute or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to speak. But he said, Oh, my Lord, please send someone else.
Okay. So I had realized when I picked Moses that this is a nice analog to the clay pot theme for Holden this summer, in which there's this powerful divine treasure, burning bush and awe-inspiring and all that, and it ends up being delivered through fairly insignificant people. And Moses is actually making that claim to get out of it. You know, please pour your treasure out to somebody else because it's just a clay pot here. What occurs to you from this sort of, it of course reproduces again the theme that Moses is a reluctant prophet, but what else? Yeah.
I guess my question would be, why did God pick Moses? Moses didn't seem to be the right man for the job.
Uh-huh.
He even had to had to tell him what to say.
Yeah.
But he got the job done.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be interesting if we only accepted people for seminary who didn't want to come? You know, that if you were eager to come, we would think that was a prima facie disqualification. And don't we sometimes, those of us who have led groups of one kind or another, aren't we sometimes cautious about people who really want to be on the committee? You know, like maybe they have their own agenda and they won't embrace the some larger thing because they're too busy doing their own thing.
Maybe God knew a little bit more about Moses, because when you follow the story, then Moses becomes such a different person. The leader that he becomes, the wisdom that he's, I mean, the compassion for his people. I mean, he becomes a very different person than this person says, oh, I really don't know how to talk, send somebody else.
It's almost like it's a prototype of what any of us could be. I mean, we're all pretty helpless at understanding God's will. I mean, and maybe it's a model, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're all a bunch of jerks, you know, and if we let God be our source of wisdom and source of spirit, no, tell them what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
When you're too full of yourself, where is there room for God?
Mm-hmm. It's a very big theme in the Old Testament. That so in either Joshua or Judges, I forget, they're sort of raising an army to capture some neighboring territory, and they think they got a pretty good army. And God says, "Oh, way too many people." You know, sort of the opposite of Colin Powell's notion. You know. Make sure you go in with enough people and then have an exit strategy to get out. No, in the Old Testament, you have no idea where you're going and how it's going to end. And the fewer people, the better, because then you'll know it was all God anyway. You know, so they whittle it down to 300 people against a cast of thousands. And then when Israel actually wins the battle, then everybody knows, well, it certainly wasn't us, because, you know, we only had 300 guys. So it must have been God. And that's a theme that you see in the Psalms and in the Old Testament, quite unlike, I would think, the way we think, the way anybody in modern culture thinks. Yeah.
Well, if he was already this great leader, then he wouldn't need God.
Mm-hmm.
And also in our present day, I think there is that tendency to think if somebody wants to be president, then, you know, there's something.
Yeah.
You don't want that person.
Yeah. And some people said that about Obama. What, you've been wanting to do this since you were like maybe an undergraduate? That in itself disqualifies you. You know, you should be a reluctant debutante. You shouldn't be seeking this.
Well, you can believe that being a prophet isn't necessarily a desirable role. Mm-hmm. Absent God's call, who would want to be a prophet?
Uh-huh.
Moses' last attempt ended in murder and running.
Yeah, that's right. He was on the lam, actually.
It wasn't so good.
Mm-hmm.
Most leadership positions at this point sort of inherited. I mean, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, you know, royalty is all inherited. And so it's already preordained by genetics.
Mm-hmm.
Who's doing what? And this is a guy who just is leading a flock of sheep.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, of course, this rough, there's this big break, this abyss between Genesis and Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, Exodus begins, this is a Pharaoh who didn't know who the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was, and Israel itself seems in discontinuity with its historic religious past. So God also, so Moses, besides the I am, Moses is also supposed to tell the people, don't you know I'm the God of your ancestors? But it's like, who were they again? Yeah.
I'm an adult baptism. I was baptized when I was 40, and rather a profligate life like St. Augustine prior to.
Does your mother pray you into the kingdom of God?
No, my mother was an ex-Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
Had no church upbringing in my life at all. Point here is that Obama is also an adult baptism. I had a little burning bush conversion experience, and I don't know what his full story is if he had a conversion experience, and he may feel
right.
He is called as a prophet as well.
Yeah, okay.
Moses was also smart enough to know that this job was going to be very unpleasant. People were going to challenge him and treat him with derision.
Yeah.
So it's not something that the portfolio doesn't look very attractive.
Yeah. Yeah, and notice in the New Testament, John the Baptist is really heading relentlessly towards his death. It's like, well, and Jesus famously says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who are sent to you, you know, what are we going to do with you? This is what you always do to divine messengers. You always kill them. Next one is a single verse, 5:1.
Afterward, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go so that they may celebrate a festival to me in the wilderness.
Okay, good. So everybody knows that line who's ever been close to Sunday school or vacation Bible school, let my people go. And we'll come back to that in a question that I have up here. If you had to distill either today's Christian message or the biblical message in a single line, you know, like an advertiser would like, what would that line be? But we'll come back to that in a second. Okay, the final verse is Deuteronomy 34:10. Somebody could read that.
Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face.
Okay. So, in case you didn't quite believe it, this is the passage also alluded to in the New Testament that makes Moses the prototypical prophet and the greatest prophet and the one who defines the prophetic role into which all future aspirants, Elijah, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Amos, fit. And then that line, so imagine at your funeral services, that's what's going on here in Deuteronomy. Imagine at, irrelevant whether you're a pastor or not, but would it likely be said of you at your funeral service, she knew God face to face? Oh, pretty potent. Please.
In keeping with that, I read in a book on world religions yesterday that Moses was regarded, of course, as the greatest prophet by the Jews, Israelites, but that he was the only prophet who could speak to God back and forth freely, whereas the other prophets knew God through dreams or visions, involuntary.
Yeah.
This was.
Yeah, and elsewhere in the Pentateuch, it talks about God who only allows his backside to be glimpsed. As you can imagine, Martin Luther, that specialist in the scatological tradition, made much of the notion that maybe that's as good as you're going to get. Only God mooning you. unless of his own free will, but not by your manipulative power, he decides to show his face to you.
Yeah, but however, every Sunday when we do the Eucharist, we see God.
It's yeah.
It is the invisible, it's the visible sign of the
invisible. Yeah, yeah.
At least for me.
Yeah. So it raises the interesting question with kind of a Jewish-Christian relations question. I think most of us today, who maybe are more enlightened about such things than people in other times in the Christian tradition, we would probably be reluctant to say today, well, Christians, yeah. I mean, Christians see God face to face in the weekly Eucharist. But in the Old Testament, nobody but Moses got to see him that way. That's not what they teach you in seminary.
Face to face, but almost today. Hidden.
Yeah, that's true. Hidden under bread and wine.
Hidden under was yeah. They taught me in fourth grade. Right?
Yeah, good point. Good point. Hidden under bread and wine.
Or in cracked pots or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Carolyn and I went to a new staff, not a new staff, but a staff party or whatever it was last night. And someone said, okay, so what's the essence of Holden? In what sense is it Lutheran? And one of the three directors said, well, it's the theology of the cross. It's not maybe Lutheranism in general, but it's the theology of the cross that defines Holden's sense of itself. Actually, you know, you can ripple that off your tongue, but in my experience, it's a little hard to write an essay of one paragraph on what exactly is the theology of the cross as understood in Luther and Paul. It's really something of a tricky proposition, but nevertheless, it's interesting that Holden asserts that about itself. That's its one determinative characteristic. Well, okay, so now Moses is in your consciousness, and now back to where we live today. The first question, is resistance to the prophetic vocation characteristic of American Christians just as it was of Moses for varying reasons? And I'm not just speaking of American clergy, but let's say the church. Do you sense that that Christianity today resists a prophetic calling?
Well, I think it's more than just Christianity. I think it's society in general. Whether you resist global warming because it upsets your economy, mm-hmm. whether you resist whatever. I mean, it's oftentimes the right thing to do mm-hmm. is hard to do because it's a change. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You're challenging the status quo, that always gets you in trouble.
Yeah, okay. So we talk about our comfort levels. Prophets never live in anybody's comfort level or their own. Abraham Heschel, a Jewish theologian of the last generation, famously said, the thing about prophet, imagine yourself as a choir director, the thing about prophets is they always sing an octave too high. You know, they're screechers. They don't blend in. You know, if you're looking for harmony, you're not going to get it from the prophet. They're the standout soprano, maybe even off key, besides being an octave too high.
Uh-huh. And people, just our whole society in general, is learning to not be as judgmental as we have in the past, which I think is a very good thing in many ways. And as people embrace that, this notion of suddenly becoming very judgmental and telling people what's wrong kind of goes against that. Huh.
But we've also been specifically warned against false prophets. And so whom do you believe? And which ones are the real ones?
And we're called to discern, to be cautious about prophets who come in sheep's clothing. Jesus warned us, and in the Old Testament as well.
The more you agree with them, the more likely they are.
Yeah, isn't that weird? If they come, unlike Jeremiah Wright, if they come bearing good news, we are and have always been God's favorite country. In fact, God himself is an honorary American. If you hear that and you go by Old Testament criteria, you're almost certainly hearing the voice of a false prophet.
Yeah.
It's way too mellow.
I guess how, if part of the prophet's role is sort of to be this mouthpiece for a message that God is trying to speak to the people, then the question is how much do we focus on the prophet himself? Or should the prophet focus on themselves? I mean, we're saying, well, we're told not to judge, and that mm-hmm. kind of goes against prophecy. But it's not the person, the prophet, that's saying this message is from. This is a God's mm-hmm. message. You know?
Yeah.
Didn't the era of prophecy end at some point in Judaism? And what about in Christianity?
Yeah, well, that's... At the end of the Old Testament period, you have prophets talking about a famine of the word of the Lord. So you've entered your desert period, and God's simply not speaking anymore. And there aren't any great prophets. That's one of the reasons John the Baptist, I think, stands out, because prophecy in ancient Israel, as we would say today, had gone into decline. But again, we could ask that ourselves. I suppose maybe most people in this room, if you had to quickly name, well, let's try it. If you had to quickly name an American Christian prophet in your lifetime, who would it be?
Martin Luther King.
Yeah, I mean, everybody knows that. Although when I was a young pastor, Palm Sunday followed Martin Luther King's assassination. This is in 1968. And the gospel text is Jesus coming into Jerusalem, Matthew 21. And I called Martin Luther King a prophet. And the president of the congregation, this is in the East Bay, California, the president of the congregation said, well, starting today, I'm not shaking your hand anymore. So that's not actually quite so long ago, 1968. And so particularly, you know, if you'd only been reading the press clippings of J. Edgar Hoover, you knew Martin Luther King was a communist, not a prophet. And possibly had extramarital affairs. So, you know, he had a besmirched character, and he moved too fast and didn't wait for people to catch up, and all those sins that prophets are always accused of. And so today, you know, if you wait a generation, then maybe even conservative people, culturally conservative people, could say, yeah, it seemed like Martin Luther King fits that category. But in the 1960s, in the late 60s, a period that I remember clearly, maybe most Americans, or a lot of Americans, wouldn't have been prepared to call Martin Luther King a prophetic figure. Maybe not even a Christian. Exactly. Yeah?
On your question about does the church resist, it appears to me that the church does a good job up to a certain point, and then it gets a little worried about losing members or something. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain line that the leaders mm-hmm. feel obligated to be careful that they don't cross.
Uh-huh.
Yes, but we just had an election with the Bush era, where the church was pounding the streets and setting an agenda, and people caught on board. And it always concerns me now with the healthcare issue to find people rattling cages and doors and screaming at our senators who are trying to talk about these things. When you ask, where did you get your information, when there's 50 million Americans uninsured, and the top CEOs of the insurance industry took last year 11.7 million, each of them, home, you know, money, and yet they're standing there screaming this, and where is the church when it comes to this health issue? I'd love to see the church come forward, because now we've got this propaganda where people believing one way. Now it's time for the church to do education, and we forget sometimes the church has to educate.
Until last week, when people were telling Obama he was starting to lose the game, I didn't hear him, and even last week he didn't quote a Bible verse or anything. But last week he gave a speech in which he said, this is a social justice issue. It's not just a government efficiency issue. But isn't it curious? So if the United States, by self-report to the Gallup people, if the United States is, whatever, 70% Christian, by self-report, isn't it odd that you couldn't get elected on a prophetic platform? And you couldn't win the health care debate on a prophetic platform. It's not as if Obama would only play his Amos card, all American Christians would line up. No, there's no reason to think that. Doesn't seem to be the case.
What do you mean by the Amos card?
Well, let justice roll, Jimmy Carter's inaugural line. Only Jimmy Carter would have a text for his inaugural address. Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness as an ever-cleansing stream. So I assume the Amos card would be, you know, you guys think God has a special relationship with the United States. If so, covenant righteousness is absolutely required of you people, you know? You don't get to claim a special relationship if you insist on living outside covenant obligations, you know? But who could say such a thing? I mean, Obama is a Christian, and he probably knows this language, but what would happen if he used this language? Would everybody say, oh, how could we have forgotten that? Of course that's true.
That's the difference between being a prophet who's outside the political mainstream and being someone who's trying to shape the political mainstream.
Yeah.
Well, what about the right-wing fundamentalists, and where do they fit into the health care, and how do they justify not dealing with it?
It's a big... It takes us well beyond the scope of this class, but... A good question to ask, I mean, I would say a good question to ask of ourselves as well, but a good question to ask of anybody, including the Christian right, is what motivates you actually biblical religion, or is it some other philosophy that really is independent of and possibly at odds with biblical religion? Carolyn and I, whenever we play hooky from our own parish, we go to St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle. And if someone said, why are you doing this? Do you hear the gospel better there than at Agnes Dei in Gig Harbor? No, no, it's just the aesthetic values are so much higher. what Hollywood would call their production values. I mean, when they do Christmas Eve, whoa, you know, it's... Cecil B. DeMille, and if you went through, you know, if you were a music major or something, or if you know something about the arts, or lowbrow people make you cringe, whatever. When you go to the worship life of a great cathedral, and if those aesthetic values are important to you, as they aren't to everybody, but then that always makes me think, as a religious studies professor, so it's really aesthetics that's driving you? It's not necessarily biblical preaching. It's that the cathedral gives you better aesthetic values. The music's better. The organ's better. It is, and it is. Well, I don't want to get too far. But, because I heard a couple times yesterday that there was a delegation here from St. Mark's in Seattle. And someone last night who is a Lutheran pastor on the cathedral staff was telling me that St. Mark's aspires to a role of embracing inclusive common ministry in the Seattle urban area. Okay, he didn't use the word, but you could even call it a chaplaincy role. St. Mark's wants to be a public space in which the whole community of goodwill in Seattle is welcome to talk about the great moral issues of the day. Okay, we sort of get that. Maybe that huge Lutheran church that I've never actually been to in Minneapolis plays that role for the Twin Cities. But if that's the role you aspire to, and surely it's a worthy role, if you're too prophetic, will it impair that role? You know, if everybody says, oh, it's St. Mark's again. You know, they show up as agitators at every city council meeting. You know, we're never doing enough for the homeless. We're never being green enough. We're never doing this. We're never doing that. And frankly, they're mostly a pain in the ass for the entire urban area. Now, you might say that's a great prophetic ministry, but I'm guessing most of us think Lutheranism doesn't quite have the tradition of a great cathedral that speaks for the region the way Catholicism and Anglicanism do. But if we also had that tradition, you probably wouldn't ask your cathedral presence to be the prophetic ministry. You know, make the campus minister do it. Nobody comes to their services anyway. And, you know, they're not serving normal people in a regular parish. They're serving college students who, you know, So, you know, the campus ministry, at least in California, where I lived most of my adult life after growing up in Dubuque, Iowa, in California, you know, campus pastors, they were the prophetic guys.
They were paid by their congregation.
Yeah, always yelling about something. And in my own parish in California, where I was a professor, I preached a lot, maybe every 6 weeks. And the pastor and I were very close theologically as well as friends, but he sometimes said to me, you don't get that many brownie points for your preaching, even if you're a good preacher. The reason your preaching has a nice prophetic ring to it is that you're not on the church's payroll. The university pays you. So you owe these people nothing in terms of being paid by them. You're paid by somebody else. So you can come here, drop your bombs, walk out, go back to your teaching job, your tenured teaching job on Monday morning, and you don't have to deal with the church council that says, you know, there could be people slacking off on their pledges because of the painful preaching you're doing. So it's interesting. I mean, so.
I guess, you know, we keep kind of talking about pastors being, by implication here, a lot of our conversations have been seminarians and pastors and everything like that. And I remember a pastor friend of mine just saying, you know, if you feel the prophetic call, then you shouldn't go to seminary or pastor. Just stay away from that whole world. You need to go where teenagers are prophet. And it's got to be outside of that whole beltway.
I apologize for continuing to make, I'm glad you said that on a number of reasons, on a number of levels. I apologize for in my illusions, making this a bit pastor-centered. Well, when Carol and I moved up from California, we were astonished to discover that we had an instant community in Gig Harbor of 10 retired clergy who instantly became our new best friends. We'd lived our life with academics being our best friends, and suddenly we had 10 retired clergy, who were including two bishops, who were our best friends. And so it's sort of they're my dialogue partners the last couple of years. So I realize this isn't a group full of retired clergy or active clergy, and I apologize for keep making allusions in that direction. And of course, in the biblical tradition, these people were not ordained. Amos wasn't ordained. Moses wasn't ordained. Elijah wasn't ordained. They were simply called, meaning God said, I want you to represent me. And so surely I should have been widening the scope. It also means that all of you who aren't clergy don't get to say, yeah, I wonder if my pastor's taking this thing seriously. No, are you taking it seriously?
No.
And then that's really the question.
I guess I just wanted to say that one thing we have sort of danced around, but one of the big reasons we resist the prophetic voice is because they're telling the truth. And who wants to listen to what the truth is? It's very painful.
Yeah.
And I'm one of the St. Mark's people. I think that at St. Mark's, it's really important to have, at least in my experience, to have one of the priests have that prophetic voice speaking to the congregation, because then it actually provides space for lay people to step up and say, oh, yes, we need to address that issue. That's something we haven't.
Yeah.
And how can we do that in our community and in the wider community?
Yeah.
So.
And isn't that nice if you are a cathedral church or any mega church? I'm being crass here, but you can staff for prophecy. Okay? So you got five pastors or five people on staff, and you can appoint one of them to the prophetic role. So you have a division of labor. If you're the solo pastor there, then if you want to play a prophetic role, you have to do it now and then, right? Some Sundays, some weekdays, but not all of them.
The evangelical community and their prophetic voice, what my friends in that realm would say is, we're being the prophetic voice against the worldly stuff that's distracting from the gospel of Jesus Christ and the centrality of Jesus Christ, all this global warming, gobbledygook, and green stuff, and I mean, that's all you're all just going down the slippery slope sort of thing. So we're being the prophetic voice of trying to keep Christ central. Whether you agree or disagree, the language that we're using, that I'm hearing today, is the same language that I would hear in those circles as well, simply different issues and different perspective.
Whenever I get to know an evangelical closely enough, evangelical as Americans define it, Evangelisch, of course, in Germany, often just means Lutheran, or at least Protestant. Whenever I get to know an evangelical well enough to have probing questions, he or she will say, oh, you're such a big prophetic role. Where, how come I don't hear your voice on abortion, the great prophetic issue of the late 20th century? Where are you on that? Why aren't you thundering God's word? That's all I'm going to say. I don't mean to get this into abortion, but so it's true that there can be some selectivity, and people on the left who are Christians or Jews sometimes get accused of being, well, that's not a prophetic voice, that's a liberal Democrat voice. And we sometimes accuse the Christian right, if we aren't on the Christian right, well, that's not a prophetic voice, that's a conservative Republican voice. And it's hard to shake it all down. We just have 5 minutes left. Let me get to a couple other questions. Whatever I am, who I am, or I will be who I will be, meant. It's an interesting question to me. If the American church, let's say somebody gave us millions of dollars to inaugurate a New York-based advertising campaign. Okay. United Church of Christ does this sometimes on TV, Methodists and so forth. So if we had an advertising campaign that somebody gave us for free, everybody on Madison Avenue donated their time and copy editors and stuff. And instead of saying, we are the American churches representing God to the United States, and the United States answers back, what God? And we say, this one. Which one? What would we say? I don't mean that we have to just speak in advertising jingles, but what would we say? How would we identify the God whose call we are experiencing and in whose name we are speaking?
Well, this is really fresh because last week we talked about conversion and the Bible study, and come and see was the each of the incidents where Jesus encounters someone and then they get sent out, you know, to, and then they try to describe what's happened, and pops into my mind.
What if you had to pick a single adjective?
Compassion.
Okay.
Benevolent.
Okay. What else?
Sustainer.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Inclusive comes to my mind.
Crucified.
Whoa, yeah. I mean, there you had to ruin it. I mean, that's the theology of the cross. Luther and Paul get that, but modern people don't get that. And notice that if you are a Christian of the right, and I acknowledge some of you might be, you might choose exclusive. God wants boundary setters. And you can find biblical warrant for boundary setters. When I'm lecturing on the history of Christianity, I sometimes quote a famous line, if you wake Calvin up in the middle of the night, and say, okay, what is it? What is it in one sense? What is it what's the essence? And Calvin says, God is sovereign. If you wake Luther up in the middle of the night, give me a one-worder, you're forgiven. So just within the Protestant tradition, two highly respectable leaders of that tradition would have given, did give in their lives, in their theology, two fairly differently new, to the extent that that anecdote is true or useful, give fairly significantly differently nuanced answers to that question. in the last minute, but you can just think about this yourself. So Moses' great message was, let my people go. If the American churches speak in the name of God to their country, what would the modern equivalent of let my people go be? Okay, nice being with you.
The test is real.
Okay.